I'm going on to, well, according to the schedule, we have two parts to sit through, basically with the same topic. In the first part, I want to address the basics of the application, scope of application of the charter. And in the second part, we look at some slightly more difficult cases. And then after that, we have the case studies where you can work on even perhaps a little bit more difficult cases yourselves, and I will pop in and out and then we'll bring you all back and we'll discuss the outcomes of those cases as decided by various courts and whether we agree with them or not. It might well be that we get through part one a bit faster than anticipated, but that we'll make up for that in part two, but we'll see how we get on, because the beginning is relatively straightforward, and I was told that you are already quite well-versed in EU law and also in the charter. So you might find this a bit, just a little refresher for you. So the first question I have is for you, warm-up question, wake-up question, is whether you have ever applied the Charter of Fundamental Rights in your judicial practice. Now, right, that's pretty encouraging. So 40% have, 60% have not. Now, I don't know how many answers we've had, but that is roughly what I would have expected. But it means that the charter is really, it does have a practical relevance down on the ground in the member states. And therefore, I'm looking forward to the case discussions later, and we'll see how we get on with those. So, okay, thank you very much for answering this. So this gives us a bit of a more context. There'll be another poll in a few minutes as well. So the charter, the key provision in the charter is right at the very end. It's Article 51.1, which is the one we have to look at. And it makes it clear that the provisions of the charter are addressed to the institutions, bodies, offices, and agencies of the Union, first and foremost. So it's mainly a charter that is meant to bind the EU and the EU's institutions in the first place. However, it is also binding on the member states, but only when they are implementing EU law. And that is, well, what this whole session is going to be about. What does it mean to be implementing EU law? And we've got the second paragraph here, subparagraph here, which is of no relevance to us. So the Union is always bound by the Charter, the member states only when they're implementing EU law, which also means, of course, that national courts will only be concerned with questions of the Charter, will only ever have to apply them in a domestic setting when they are implementing or when they are reviewing the implementation of EU law, where EU law is at stake. But this terminology, implementing EU law, is perhaps a bit unfortunate, and because it is a bit narrower than what it actually means. Before we come to the meaty questions of what the scope of the charter is, I just want to take a step back and maybe reflect briefly upon why does it actually matter if the charter is addressed to the member states? Well, first of all, as I said, it means that the charter can be invoked before a member state court, and that can go in two directions. First of all, the member state court must consider compliance of this member state measure in question with the charter. So if you've got a European arrest warrant, that whole process of the European arrest warrant being carried out and executed in your member state is of course subject to charter rights. But also it has another angle, which we'll come back to at the end, which is that the procedure before your court has to be compliant with the procedural rights in the Charter, Articles 47, 48, 49, and 50. So that is a side effect of the Charter applying, of you as a judge applying EU law in your court. You also have to comply with the procedural rights laid down in the Charter. And now, obviously, in most cases, there won't be any difference to the procedural requirements that are there under domestic law anyway, but in some cases it can make a difference, and we'll come back to one or two of those at the end. The second important aspect is, of course, that the charter is EU law. If you apply the charter, you're applying EU law, and EU law is coupled with the doctrine of primacy of EU law. That means EU law prevails over anything that is domestic law. So the charter may mean that you have to set aside or not apply, technically, not apply certain provisions of your domestic law, including the constitution. Yeah, it's fairly clear from the basic case law on primacy, Familienrechtslos, Costa, Internationale Handelsgesellschaft, Simmental, that every court is obliged to disapply contravening domestic law. Thus, the applicability of the charter may well determine the outcome of your domestic proceedings. Now, as I said, in many cases, you will have overlaps between the fundamental rights you have in your domestic legal system and charter rights, and maybe the European Convention on Human Rights. They might all say the same and make the same requirements. You don't have to worry about the charter too much. But in some cases, there will be differences, and that's where it is important to realize or to check, does the charter apply? When the charter applies, you have to apply it rather than maybe a less generous provision of domestic law or a provision of domestic law that stands in the way. Now, what does implementing mean? As I said, the wording is a bit unfortunate. It's unfortunate because it's too narrow. And if we look at the explanations to the charter, which are an interesting little glimpse at what the drafters of the charter wanted, but you know the explanations are as old as the charter, so they're 21, 22 years old at this stage. You will see that the drafters of the charter meant that implementing means when member states, that situations where member states are acting in the scope of EU law. And in fact, that reflects pre-charter case law. There is reference to two cases, which are the leading cases on when the previous regime of fundamental rights in EU law applied. They were fundamental rights guaranteed as so-called general principles of EU law, unwritten fundamental rights, but still enforceable in the domestic courts and also in the Court of Justice. Two cases, one is Wachauf, the other is ERT. Wachauf is the implementing situation in the narrow sense. Here we had an authority, German legislation, and a German authority acting on the basis of that legislation, which itself was based on EU measures and EU regulation in the area of the common agricultural policy. And this was all about whether a farmer who gave up dairy production could get compensation for that. And there was a scheme under EU law, but the German legislation excluded farmers who were only tenants on their land, not owners of the land, unless they got the written consent of the owner. And Wachauf complained and said, well, this is contrary to my right to property because, you know, I've invested a lot of money in my machinery and all of that. I should be compensated for giving up dairy production because I suppose at the time there was an overproduction of milk in the EU. So that is a typical implementing situation. Yeah, member state authority acting on the basis of EU law and EU regulation and EU directive, perhaps, or the treaties themselves. The ERT case is the one that steps a little bit outside the implementing category, where, you know, if we look at the wording, what does implementing mean? It means applying EU law, you know, making EU law work, acting as an agent, so to speak, of the EU. And in the ERT case, we had a member state that was deviating from fundamental freedoms. Now, as you know, the EU single market is built on four freedoms: free movement of goods, freedom to provide services, free movement of persons, and freedom of capital. And here we had a television broadcasting monopoly in Greece, which protected ERT, the state broadcaster, and a private broadcaster wanted to challenge that. They wanted to set up a broadcasting station, a TV station, and they were told they couldn't. And they complained that this is contrary to their freedom to provide services under EU law, but also, crucially, that it is contrary to their right to freedom of speech, which is now in Article 11 of the Charter. Back then, they quoted Article 10 of the ECHR. And here the court said, yeah, well, where a member state makes exceptions to free movement law, derogates from free movement law, invoking those provisions, you know, in the treaties that allow derogations for reasons of public policy, public security, public health, and so on and so on, then this derogation has to be compliant with fundamental rights. So you've got these two situations, and they're still there, and we're going to look at the case law in a minute, where on the one hand, implementing or the scope of EU law better means either a member state acting, applying EU law, acting as an agent of the EU, in the broadest sense, or where a member state wants to deviate from EU law obligations and invokes one of those derogation provisions in EU free movement law or elsewhere. So they're the two situations. And that was carried over into the charter by the court's case law. We're going to look at that case law now. Now, the leading case is, of course, Françon. Most of you will probably have come across this, especially the ones who have applied the charter in their courts before. And that came, well, I'll not comment on the case just yet. So we have here a person prosecuted in Sweden for three things. They hadn't declared their income tax, they hadn't declared their VAT, their value added tax, and they hadn't declared Social Security that they had to pay to the state. Now, he had already received an administrative fine by the tax authorities for not declaring his tax, but now the state prosecutor is coming after him and wants to nab him as well. So he wants to criminally prosecute him as well as that. And what he's saying is that is illegal because there is a provision in the Charter of Fundamental Rights that says ne bis in idem, non bis in idem, or the prohibition of double jeopardy, as we would call it in the common law jurisdictions, where you can't be punished twice for the same act. So no one shall be held liable to be tried or punished again in criminal proceedings for an offence for which he or she has already been finally acquitted or convicted within the union in accordance with the law. And he said, well, I've already been convicted of this. I've already paid a fine. That is a penalty to the tax authorities. You can't come after me under criminal law now. Okay, now, next poll, please. Do you think that in this case where Mr. Françon invokes the charter in a case, in a criminal prosecution, where he's charged with income tax fraud, VAT fraud, and social security fraud, does the charter apply in such a case? Are we in the scope of EU law, in other words? Is the member state implementing EU law? What do you think? Well, most of you probably know this case, but anyway, what do you think? When the case came about, that was, you know, not at all clear, and certainly very much a debatable point. Okay, so we've got a fairly clear majority in favor of the charter applying, and you are right. However, remember that the Advocate General at the time, Cruz Villalón, was very much against the charter applying in this case, and I think maybe not a majority of EU lawyers, but it was definitely 50-50, where people thought this is definitely not the charter, because, you know, criminal law has nothing to do with EU law. It's a domestic setting, can't apply the charter. The court saw it differently. Now, the court clarified, first and foremost, that the charter applies, well, where we are within the scope of EU law. So it adopted this broad definition. At the time, it wasn't quite clear whether implementing was actually a deviation from previous case law, whether it meant the narrower agency situations, or whether it was the broad situations that we were used to from the pre-charter case law. I make clear, no, we're still doing the same thing. We're looking at whether we are within the scope of EU law. And this, in this case, we are in the scope of EU law in part, not the full, not all of the cases in the scope of EU law, but some of it. The court pointed to the pre-charter case law, pointed to the charter explanations, all of this fairly unspectacular, but going against the Advocate General's opinion, okay? Very important and unusual in EU law, really. Now here, the court said, look, we have to look at the case in detail. There are basically three issues that are being raised: income tax fraud, VAT fraud, and social security fraud. There's no EU legislation really on income tax or social security contributions. Yeah? There's something on coordination between different member states, but that is not an issue here. So the court is not dealing with anything EU law related on these two points. So that part of the case is not in the scope of EU law. By contrast, VAT is heavily determined by EU law. There are many VAT directives, which all of which require member states to make sure that VAT is collected correctly. So they all require member states to take all legislative and administrative measures appropriate for ensuring collection of all the VAT due on its territory and for preventing evasion. So member state has to do something to prevent evasion. Member state is charging somebody with a criminal offense because they've evaded VAT. That seems to tick the box, yeah? Then there's an obscure provision, Article 325 TFEU, which is in the budgetary part of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, which obliges member states to counter all illegal activities affecting the interests of the EU. And because the EU receives a share of a member state's VAT revenue, a tiny share, but still one, any VAT fraud affects the interests of the EU, the financial interests of the EU. Therefore, we're in here as well. So two arguments why we are there in the scope of EU law, where the VAT fraud is concerned, not where everything else is concerned. That's important. And it also means, I mean, the lesson from Akbar Franson is A, we've got a broad understanding of implementing EU law. But the second lesson of Akbar Franson is that cases can be split almost artificially along the lines of the charter. So what I mean by this is, now in this case, the Court of Justice gave a strong hint, and I think in the end in Sweden, that's how it was decided, gave a strong hint that there is no problem with double jeopardy, with non bis in idem in this case. Yeah, Article 50 didn't kick in, Franson couldn't invoke it. But you could imagine a case where, income tax fraud and social security fraud are outside the scope of the charter. The national prosecution can go ahead, he can be convicted, whereas the bits that are within the scope of the charter relating to VAT, the national prosecution cannot go ahead because there's a violation of the charter right. And so your case may be split artificially into two parts, one which is governed by the charter, the other that isn't. And then it really depends on your domestic legislation, whether you think, okay, our domestic law, our domestic fundamental rights have to be interpreted in the same way, or they don't. And you may have a different outcome of the case depending on whether the charter applies and whether it not applies. So it is a bit strange, perhaps, because that two different regimes can govern one and the same type of legal proceeding. The other case that is important, as lesser known, because it's also quite a boring case and fairly uncontroversial, but it just confirmed the ERT limb of the scope of EU law. So Akerberg Franson reaffirmed, okay, we have a broad reading of the scope of EU law, but it's basically an agency case. Here we had a situation where a member state was prosecuting for VAT fraud on behalf, if you want to put it like that, on behalf of the EU. The EU has an interest that there's no VAT fraud. The Pfleger case is about deviations from or derogations from free movement law. Here, we're in Austria. Austria prohibits games of chance. So that means it prohibits these kind of little slot machines that you have in pubs and, you know, in bars where you put in €2 and you press a button and you hope you're hoping to win. But, you know, at the end of the day, you will always lose. And this is prohibited in Austria. And the authorities raided a few pubs in Austria and they seized these machines and find the operators. Now, one of them happened to be from the Czech Republic. So we had a cross-border service provider. And they invoked, amongst other things, that their charter rights, 15 to 17 CFR, that's the right to work, the right to conduct a business, the right to property, all of these kind of commercial rights that you will find in the charter have been violated. And here, the court said, look, in principle, yes, we're in the scope of EU law because the member state is restricting freedom to provide services. Yeah, I said, precisely, it follows that where a member state relies on overriding requirements in the public interest in order to justify rules which are liable to obstruct the exercise of the freedom to provide services, such justification provided for by EU law must be interpreted in the light of the general principles of EU law, in particular the fundamental rights henceforth guaranteed by the Charter. So wherever we have that, wherever a member state is using a derogation provision that allows the member state to deviate from EU law, we're still within the scope of EU law. The member state still has to abide by the Charter rights and respect them. In this case, the court accepted the Austrian public policy of not allowing these types of games. Gambling is an interesting issue throughout the EU. The rules between member states differ greatly, and this is just an example. And therefore, we did not have a problem in the end. We did not have a violation, but the Charter nonetheless applies in these kinds of cases. That has now been clarified by the court. Now, before we come to the discussion in about 5 minutes or so, just want to reiterate, what are the consequences of these cases? Implementing EU law is a broad construction. It means within the scope of EU law. And that means there are two situations. Member states are either applying EU law or they're carrying out duties under EU law. They're doing something with EU law, or in the alternative, they deviate from fundamental freedoms. They're deviating from fundamental, the four freedoms of the single market. And as the court said it, I think it's in France on this kind of mantra, but I think it is quite useful. The Charter applies what EU law applies. So whenever you're applying EU law, be it derogating from EU law or just applying EU law and EU law provision, the Charter kicks in. And that's it. That's all there is to know. Now, it's not always that easy to know whether EU law applies because that is not always so predictable, but we'll come to that in the second part. Where we have an implementation, where the Charter applies, it applies with the full force of EU law. EU law primacy overrides everything at domestic level, or pretty much everything at domestic level. You must apply EU law and not apply any contravening domestic law. And that, as I said before, as we had in France, it may require you to split up a case in almost artificially in bits that where the Charter applies, the case may go one way, and bits where the Charter does not apply, the case may go another way. And that's just the way these things work, I'm afraid. And we'll see a case like that later on again. Now, what are the criteria? It's very difficult for the Court of Justice to draw up a checklist. Yeah, the Charter applies. It's too context specific, but they tried to give us a few hints in this very unimportant, but otherwise very unimportant case, an unspectacular case of Siragusa. Now this fella, he had built illegally on his land without planning permission, and the local authority ordered him to remove the buildings that he had erected illegally. Now he wasn't happy about that, no surprise, challenged this in the Italian courts, and invoked Article 17 of the Charter, his right to property. The problem was the case was not really in the scope of EU law. But he invoked things like the directive on environmental information, the right to environmental information, and a few other random bits of EU law. The problem was that none of them really were biting. So the Court of Justice gave us this checklist. Where it says that in order to determine whether national legislation involves the implementation of EU law for the purposes of Article 51 of the Charter, some of the points to be determined are whether, A, is the legislation intended to implement a provision of EU law? So if you're looking at national legislation that is there to implement a directive, and often the national legislation will say that, this is to implement Directive 2000/78, then yes, we're obviously implementing EU law under the Charter applies. What is the nature of that legislation? Does it pursue objectives other than those covered by EU law, even if it is capable of indirectly affecting EU law? Does it indirectly affect EU law somehow? Are there specific EU law rules on the matter capable of affecting the legislation? Now, if we go back to Franson, one detail I didn't tell you about is that the criminal legislation in Sweden that prohibited VAT fraud and made that a criminal offense was adopted in the 1960s, 30 years or so before Sweden became a member state of the EU. But that didn't matter because there was this overlap in terms of the duty that the member state was under to pursue VAT fraud and the legislation. And so that kind of overlap in terms of substance is enough. So Siragusa just gives us an indication. It's not as an exhaustive list, but it gives us an idea of what is covered, okay? And in this case, as I said, there was no connection to EU law. The applicant just invoked random bits of EU law that didn't apply of them at all, and which the national authority had not applied at all. It was simply a matter of domestic planning law, which was not related to EU law. He hadn't got a planning permission. He couldn't invoke EU law. He couldn't invoke Article 17 of the Charter. And he lost that point of his case anyway in the ECJ. We just take stock again. So we need to be in the scope of EU law. Two situations: we've either got implementing or applying EU law, or deviating from EU free movement law. So as soon as the dispute is somehow governed by EU law, we are in the scope. So the key threshold is actually we need to know when does EU law actually apply. Yeah, when does EU law apply? And that's where it gets a bit difficult. And the case law, okay, it's always logical, I find, but in some situations, I think it is difficult to predict where the court might end up, and we'll come to them towards the end here. Now, there's one thing that is not relevant. Yeah, it's important. One thing that is not relevant at all, and that is whether the EU has, in theory, got the competence to legislate in a particular area. That is not relevant in every respect. Yeah? It would be an easy one. You could think, okay, we'll just look at the EU's competences, you know, articles 3 to 5 or 6 of the TFEU, and we know. But no, that is absolutely, it's a red herring. It's not relevant. It's not relevant, A, in this situation where we've got an area in which the members, the EU has no competence whatsoever. The example is the case of Sayn Wittgenstein, which is one of those more amusing cases in EU law, I find anyway. I might have a different sense of humor. But as somebody coming from a republic, I find it very funny. It's this lady who's an Austrian national, and she, and Austria has an absolute ban on titles of the nobility. So you're no longer allowed to call yourself count or prince or something like that, princess, yeah? In Austria, even if you used to belong to the royal family there, that's all gone. And she thought, well, that's not a good idea. I want to get myself, she got herself adopted in Germany by a German noble person, by a prince. And so she became a princess under German law. And she said, okay, I want to have that princess title in my Austrian passport. So he went to Austria and they said, no, you can't have it. You know, look at our legislation where we've abolished the nobility. Forget about it, sunshine. And she said, well, but that's contrary to my EU law rights because I'm a free mover. I used to live in Germany. Now I'm moving back to Austria. She was probably still living in Germany, but I'm an Austrian national, having made use of my free movement rights, you have to grant me the name as it was given to me by the German authorities. And it is quite clear that the EU has no competence whatsoever on naming conventions. Yeah, the way we are called, I know there are some Spanish colleagues here in the call, you have very specific naming laws. The Germans have their own specific naming laws. I know that as a German. I know that the Austrians have their prohibition on these titles of nobility, and every country does whatever it wants. But, says the Court of Justice, it's irrelevant, the competence issue, because even where member states are acting within their own competence, within their own exclusive sphere, they must still do so under the constraints of EU law. So EU law may still constrain them, yeah, in some respects. And if you have a free mover, that is always the typical example. they may have rights to have their names accepted. So we have a lot of case law already on this in EU law about, you know, children born to parents in another EU member state, named according to the rules in that member state, which would not be acceptable in their home member state. The home member state, generally speaking, has to accept their names, okay? However, so there are lots of member states that ban double barrel surnames, like, you know, Avello Garcia was one of those cases. Yeah, a Spanish double barrel surname would not be permissible, generally speaking, in Germany, for instance. We don't allow that. But if there's a free movement angle, the Germans have to accept it. Yeah. And she invoked the same rules. So the charter can be invoked. Yeah, she's a free mover. The member state is deviating from free movement law, technically speaking, because they're denying her the name that she actually wants, that she has acquired in another member state. And in this case, they were justified because they were able to invoke their national constitutional identity as a republic that simply got rid of these titles of nobility to ensure equality between members of the public. Everyone is the same. Everyone is a citizen. There's no hierarchy between the former nobility and the ordinary citizen. So that they got away with it, but the charter technically applied. It was just the restriction of her rights under the charter were justifiable. And it also works in the other direction. So the mere fact, says the court in the case called Hernandez, the mere fact that a national measure comes within an area in which the EU has competence to legislate, but didn't legislate, you know, they didn't do anything, does not bring it within the scope of the charter. Now, this was a labor law case, and it was about the question whether a distinction in Spanish law between an unfair dismissal of an employee and an invalid dismissal of an employee is justifiable, because there were different legal consequences attached to it. And Hernandez had been invalidly dismissed, and therefore lost out on a compensation that he would have received because his employer went bankrupt. If he had been unfairly dismissed, he would have gotten the compensation. And he said, that's a violation of equal treatment under the Charter, Article 20. But the court said, but EU law does not deal with unfair and invalid dismissal. The EU law deals with discrimination and working time and all sorts of things in labor law. And yes, the EU could adopt rules on unfair dismissal, but it hasn't. And therefore, the mere fact that EU law provides for a competence that the EU has not used or not fully used does not mean that the case comes within the scope of EU law. So the real question is, that means we're coming back to what I said before. The question always is, does EU law apply? Is EU law applied in this case? Does it govern the case in any respect? In any material respect, yeah? In the Sein-Wittgenstein case, yes, it governed the case because she was a free mover and she was denied something she acquired in another EU member state. In Hernandez, it did not apply because there was no EU rule, EU regulation, EU directive or anything that related to this case at all, okay? Or this particular point he was invoking, there were other aspects that were EU law relevant, but not this particular point. Now, simple cases, and they're obviously the nice ones, are the ones where member states take measures on the basis of EU law. Typical decision you may have come across in your own practice, we have a decision under the Dublin regulation by one member state, and they realize, oh, there's an asylum seeker here, somebody applying for refugee status. But they're already on the database. They have entered the EU through Greece, say, and we're going to send them back to Greece. That is a typical example where a member state is applying EU law, is using EU law rules, EU law rights, if you want to put it like that. And obviously the charter applies to this. Now, in the cases of NS and ME, they're very famous cases, the Court of Justice held that these people were able to rely on their rights under the charter to fight off a take-back request under the Dublin regulation because they were supposed to be sent to Greece. And at the time, the conditions for asylum seekers in Greece were so bad that it amounted to what is called inhuman and degrading treatment in Article 4 of the Charter, and that meant they couldn't be sent there. In a similar vein, European arrest warrant cases. Somebody is arrested, they come before your court, they say, I don't want to go to this other, you know, wherever, Spain or Ireland, because I think I, you know, my right to a family life would be affected by this. And then you have to apply the charter. Again, in most cases, unsuccessfully, but in the case, for instance, of Aran Josi, and now the Romanian colleagues may excuse me, Caldararu, or I don't know how this is pronounced, this particular case, the court said, yes, these people were able to show that the conditions in the prisons that they were supposed to be sent to were so bad, and that was Hungary and Romania respectively, that they could fight off a European arrest warrant by invoking the Charter, Article 4, inhuman and degrading treatment or punishment. Again, these are very rare cases, but in all of these cases where you're basically applying an EU law regulation, an EU framework decision, the Charter applies. Very easy, straightforward, simple, okay? It's more difficult where member states are given discretion. Discretion, you know, if you look at this case here of Camberai, this is the long-term residence directive. So the long-term residence directive has the aim of giving more or less the same rights as, has the aim of protecting people, third country nationals, non-EU nationals who have lived in an EU member state for more than 5 years, they're long-term residents, and they acquire rights very similar to those of EU law EU nationals, okay? And one of the provisions in the directive says long-term residents shall enjoy equal treatment with nationals as regards social security and so on and so on, as defined by national law. Now, what does that mean? Is this what is defined by national law? Is that in the scope of EU law or is it in the scope of national law only? Yeah? It's not quite clear. Yeah, if you look at the wording, as defined by national law, you could think, well, this has nothing to do with EU law. It's for the national states, the member states, to define this. And EU law does not interfere. But, of course, you would be mistaken if you did that. It's the same thought process that goes into these cases of ERT and Pfleger, where member states are deviating from EU law. They still have to comply with the charter. And the same here, where they're defining something, where they're given discretion by EU law. EU law gives them discretion. They must comply with the charter as well, okay? So in Camberai, the situation was very specific to the province of Bolzano in Italy, which is bilingual, German and Italian. And all social benefits apparently are divided between the language groups. So, you know, there's a pot for the German speakers, a pot for the Italian speakers, and then there's a pot for the those who don't fit into any of the groups who are third country nationals, yeah, non-German speakers, non-Italian speakers, there's something else. And the problem was that this pot was so small, it was disproportionately small, so it was discrimination. And Camberai was able to invoke the charter to fight this because the member state, when defining these social security benefits, these social assistance benefits, when defining them, it was acting within the scope of EU law because the long-term residence directive gives it the discretion, but it says you have to still stay within this, you're acting under the scope of EU law. You're defining these things yourselves. So that's what the court said, okay? So he was able to invoke the charter here. And the same goes for situations like this in Stefan, which is a fairly unknown case here. And an absolutely random person, I think, as far as we can tell. So we had here a flooding on a river in Austria, and that caused a lot of damage. And the Austrian prosecutors went after went after the lock keepers, the people who were supposed to keep the locks on the river. They probably were supposed to keep them open, and they didn't. And they went after them and criminally prosecuted them for negligent operation of these locks, for causing this flood. And a member of the public, completely unrelated to these cases, was seeking information about rainfall and flooding and all sorts of things on this particular river at this particular time when the criminal case happened. And the authorities said, we'll give you this information, but not yet. We'll give it to you after these criminal trials are over, because we would be risking the integrity of the criminal trial. Yeah? And we have to protect the criminal trial under Article 47 of the Charter. Yeah, that's our obligation, to make sure that the criminal trial happens fairly. Now, there's an environmental information directive. There's a directive that gives you access to environmental information, and it formulates exceptions to that right. And that's the right that Mr. Stefan was invoking. He said, I want my environmental information under Austrian legislation. And in this case, which was implementing the directive. And there it says, member states may, however, provide for a request for environmental information to be refused if this would adversely affect the course of justice, and so on and so on. Austria invoked this. The court said, still, we are within the scope of the charter, so we have to review whether the charter right would be affected in this case. And they said, no, it wouldn't be. And therefore, Mr. Stefan lost his case. But still, it's important to realize that wherever the member state acts within a discretion given to it by a piece of EU legislation, we're in the scope of the charter. That seems to be the message in those two cases. So it's a broader reading than it could be. Yeah, you could have a narrower reading. I think it would be intellectually totally honest argument to say, well, in those cases, there shouldn't be any application of the charter. But no, it's the other way around. The charter applies where the member state acts under discretion given to it by them, by EU law, because EU law applies. Yeah? And then we've got the broader scope of EU law cases. They're what I would call wacky cases. Yeah? They are very, very difficult. And I think they're the ones, you know, if you ever come across a case like this, and there isn't much you can do but refer it to the Court of Justice, because I think these kinds of cases are unpredictable. Yeah, I mean, I do this almost every year. I give these to my students, yeah, without telling them what the outcome was. And do you think the charter applies? And obviously my students don't know much about law, but, you know, just as a random exercise, and, you know, you get very, very widely differing opinions. And I think in Küçük Deveci, which is a follow-up to the very famous Mangold case, that was certainly the case as well, because it was not obvious that EU law applied. Now, here we had a labor law case. Ms. Küçük Deveci was dismissed, or had been dismissed, by her employer. She was 28 years of age, and she had worked for the employer for 10 years. Now, under German law, the longer you have worked for your employer, the longer the termination period, yeah, is, the notice period is, that they have to give you. And normally, after 10 years of employment, you'd get 4 months notice. But there was an exception in German law, which went back to the 1930s, which meant that any time she served working for the employer up to the age of 25 was not counted. So young people were not as well protected as older people. And therefore, we only started counting at 25, so it was 25, 26, 27, 28. So it was 3 years that she had worked for the employer for purposes of the length of the notice period, and she only got 1 month. So she was seeking 3 months pay, basically. And she argued that is age discrimination. Yeah? The charter prohibits the discrimination on the basis of age. And, you know, it's quite clearly age discrimination, direct age discrimination, even you're using a number to distinguish between different categories of employees. The question is this in the scope of EU law? Now, there is no EU legislation on the length of notice periods. Yeah? There is EU legislation on age discrimination. However, at the Framework Directive 2000/78, However, this had not been implemented correctly by Germany because this age discrimination was still in the legislation. And we had a case dealing between two private parties. And there's a long, long standing line of case law under in EU law that says you cannot have direct effect of a directive in horizontal cases, in cases between private parties. So she was not able to rely on the directive. Yeah. Okay. So a lot of people at the time before this case was decided would have said, well, it's a shame, but tough. Yeah. Germany has to change the law. Yes, but she can't win this case because it's her employer, who's a private employer, who can't be taking the hit for Germany misapplying or misimplementing a directive. Now, the first question was then for the court to decide, can we do this on the basis of the charter? Are we in the scope of EU law? And very oddly, the court looked at that very directive that did not have direct effect, that Germany had implemented wrongly, but that cannot normally be invoked in this case because we're dealing with a private law case, and said, oh yeah, well, the directive, which is about non-discrimination, yeah, first and foremost, the framework directive is about non-discrimination on the basis of age, disability, sexual orientation, and religion and belief. Yeah, that directive can't be invoked in the case because it's a horizontal case, but the court nonetheless referred to it and said, yeah, but we're in the scope of EU law because we're dealing here with, you know, hiring and firing of people, yeah, the dismissal of employees. And the directive somehow deals with the dismissal of employees, even though very narrow aspects of it, but it deals with the dismissal of employees. And therefore, this case is in the scope of EU law. Now, that is a really, really tricky argument, I think. It's not particularly convincing. Nonetheless, you can see that the court applies a very broad scope of very broad understanding of the scope of EU law in certain cases. It says here, this directive does not apply in the case itself. It can't govern the case because of because it's a horizontal case and because Germany has not implemented the directive correctly. But nonetheless, the broad subject matter of the directive is dismissal of employees. And this is about the dismissal of employees. So we're in the scope of EU law. I personally can't find that convincing, but that is the breadth of the scope of EU law. Yeah, so it's very unpredictable. And if you go back to the case I mentioned earlier, Hernandez, which was about the unfair invalid dismissal, there the court said, oh, it's nothing to do with EU law, even though it's also about the dismissal of employees. How are you supposed to know that? Doesn't make a lot of, you know, it's not very coherent. I could go on about this for hours, but I won't. Another case that shows you the breadth of the scope or the potential breadth of the scope of EU law is the Telisverige and Watson case. Now, this followed, this was about domestic legislation in Sweden and in the UK. We'll focus on Sweden just for the purpose of this. Domestic legislation in Sweden about data retention of communication data. Yeah, retention of communication data. So mobile phone data, location data, text messages, who you called, whose calls you received, and so on. And that had been adopted in order to implement the data retention directive of the EU. But in the meantime, the data retention directive of the EU had been declared invalid by the ECJ because it violated the charter. That was the case of Digital Rights Ireland, okay, famous case. The Swedish and the UK still went ahead and just copied and pasted these things into their domestic legislation. They said, okay, the directive is gone, but within our own competence, we could just simply adopt it anyway. And the question is that in the scope of EU law? Because obviously there were people who were saying, well, if the original directive is contrary to the charter, then the national legislation that you have just invented, that is basically a copy and paste job from the directive that you're now adopting as national legislation, must also be contrary to the charter. But are we in the scope of EU law? And there, the Court of Justice considered whether Directive 2002/58, which is also about the which is about data protection, processing of personal data, and the protection of privacy in the electronic communications sector, applied. Now, there was one problem. And that is that the directive does not apply to activities of the state in areas of criminal law. And the main purpose of the national legislation was to facilitate the prosecution of criminal offenses, okay? Telecommunication data, you know better than I, is very, very valuable evidence when it comes to the prosecution of criminal offenses, yeah? And the directive says it does not apply to this. However, it also says in Article 15, member states may adopt legislative measures to restrict data subjects' rights to safeguard national security and the prevention, investigation, detection, prosecution of criminal offenses or of unauthorized something else, I can't remember. Now, Article 15 allows certain member state measures, yeah, gives some discretion to the member states to facilitate the prosecution of criminal offenses. At the same time, Article 1.3 says that the directive does not apply to activities of the state in areas of criminal law. Now, obviously the member states concerned, Sweden and the UK, argued, well, we're not in the scope of EU law. The directive does not apply here. Thank you very much. Case closed. The counter position was Article 15 says member states may adopt legislative measures for the protection of criminal offenses. So how can that be? They're acting within the scope of EU law because they're using an EU law derogation, Article 15, from those rights in the directive, okay? And the court said, look, admittedly, it's always, you know, it's always one of those things where you have to be careful when you start a sentence with admittedly. But anyway, admittedly, the legislative measures that are referred to in Article 15.1 of the directive concern activities characteristic of states or state authorities and are unrelated to fields in which individuals are active. Moreover, the objectives which under that provision such measures must pursue, such as safeguarding national security, defense and public security, and prevention, investigation, detection and prosecution of criminal offenses, and so on and so on, overlap substantially with the objectives pursued by the activities referred to in Article 1.3 of that directive, so those that are excluded from the scope of the directive. That is the, you know, maybe a drafting problem, but anyway. Court said, however, having regard to the general structure of Directive 2002/58, the factors identified in the preceding paragraph of this judgment do not permit the conclusion that the legislative measures referred to in Article 15.1 of the directive are excluded from the scope of that directive, because otherwise that wouldn't make any sense. It would have no purpose. If the directive allows you to deviate from the rules in the directive in order to facilitate the investigation of crimes, then this whole deviation can't be outside the scope of the directive, because otherwise the provision, Article 15.1, would not make sense. And therefore, these Swedish measures were within the scope of EU law, and therefore they had to be measured by the standards of the Charter. That's a very roundabout way. And again, I think it's in a situation where you could have easily arrived at a different outcome. It's not at all predictable, in my view, and not at all, not necessarily convincing. I think it's relatively convincing, but not to everybody. So these difficult cases, they leave us, you know, with a lot of question marks. Now, the good news is that, you know, that the obvious cases, there are many of those, and, you know, you have to apply the Charter. There also was one further example, apart from the Siragusa case, of something that is too remote. And again, we're dealing with a very similar situation. Anibaldi was a farmer and in Italy, in Lazio, and he had land that was incorporated into a nature and archaeological park, which basically meant that he couldn't do anything with his land. So he was prevented from, change changing the cultivation of the land. So he couldn't change the plants that were growing there. He couldn't move the soil. He couldn't drive on it. He couldn't build any structures on it. Nothing. I mean, it's basically, it was not, he just had to let his land sit there and be part of that nature park, a nature reserve. And he said, well, this is basically an expropriation and I haven't been paid for it. And that is contrary to the charter, Article 17. Now, this was a pre-charter case, so he didn't invoke the charter, he invoked the right to property as a general principle. Now, does this measure implement EU law? Are we in the scope of EU law, or are we not in the scope of EU law? And here the court gave us two quick sentences to rebuke any connection to EU law. It said, against this background, it is clear, first of all, that there's nothing in the present case to suggest that the regional law, which was intended to implement a provision of community law, either in the sphere of agriculture or in that of the environment or culture. So there was nothing to suggest that there was an implementation of EU law here at all. And even if the regional law were capable of affecting indirectly the operation of a common organization of the agriculture markets, it is not in dispute that the park having been created to protect and enhance the value of the environment and the cultural heritage of the area concerned, the regional law pursues objectives other than those covered by the common agricultural policy, or that the law itself is general in character. So it had nothing to do with EU law. So, but in some cases, I think it is very difficult to predict. Yeah, and it's really, it's a very case law heavy area of the law. It is, and in some cases, and I think that they're the two last ones we looked at, Teles Verige, and before that, the case of Küçük Deveci. You know, if you ever come across a case like this and you really don't know, I think that the only solution is to refer the case to the Court of Justice. But hopefully you won't have to ever worry about that too much. Anyway, one thing, the last thing I want to mention before we go back to the discussion is an important consequence, I think, it can't be reiterated enough, is that even if the substance of the case is unrelated, even if there's no question of the charter affecting the substance of the case, the actual question that is at stake, it may still be that the procedural rights of the charter apply and govern your procedure. So an example would be, for instance, some of these European arrest warrant cases, where the in the LM case that I have here, we had a reference from an Irish court, from the Irish Supreme Court, in a European arrest warrant case where LM was wanted by the Polish authorities. And LM argued, I shouldn't be sent to Poland because in Poland, the courts have deteriorated to such an extent that I can't be guaranteed a fair trial. So Article 4 had nothing to do with the substance of the matter. Is he, you know, he didn't challenge the European arrest warrant under any of the provisions of the framework directive, the framework decision that sets up the European arrest warrant. He invoked a procedural right. In DEB, we had a state liability claim. And DEB was a company and they were seeking legal aid from the German state to pursue a state liability claim against the German state, EU state liability claim, Frankovic, Brasserie de Fischer and those cases. And German law does not grant legal aid to companies, only to natural persons. And they were saying, this is contrary to my EU law rights, to Article 47, I can't be guaranteed a fair trial. Again, here, the invocation of the procedural right had nothing to do with the substance of the case, but because the substance of the case was an EU state liability claim, obviously it was governed by EU law and the procedure had to comply with EU law. And therefore, it was a question of EU law whether legal aid had to be granted to the company or not. And the same will be the case in Brussels regulation cases, family law, Brussels 2B or Brussels 1 cases, data protection cases, EU free movement law cases, and so on and so on. Your procedure will always have to be complied, or you will have to be prepared for parties to invoke Article 47 of the Charter and saying, I haven't gotten a fair trial here. I'm not, you know, procedure is not fair. It's not compliant with Article 47. So the conclusion, just to wrap up, is really the Charter applies where any other EU law norm applies to the case, or at least where the domestic measure that the party wants set aside comes within the scope of other norms of EU law. So EU law governs the case in any respect, you're probably within the scope of the Charter. I think the Siragusa checklist is not bad as a starting point, but it is not, of course, exhaustive in any respect, especially the argument that a measure is within the member state's exclusive competence or something is not in itself conclusive, because you always have to think about, oh, is there a free movement angle to the case? Is there something else? Yeah. And then the member state's discretion to do whatever it wants with its exclusive competence is restricted as well. So, and that makes these cases so difficult. Yeah.